You know, it's really funny how our brains process security. Imagine like moving into a new house, right? And you pay top dollar for this state-of-the-art security system. You've got this sleek control panel right there on the wall by the front door.
Oh, I know exactly the kind you mean.
Yeah, and every night you tap the little button, it glows green, and you go to sleep feeling perfectly safe. But then one day you look a little closer at that panel.
And you realize something's off.
Exactly. You realize it's not actually wired to anything. It's not even a real screen. It's literally just a drawing of a padlock on a piece of plastic. The doors, well, they were never locked.
Oh, wow. That is, yeah, that highlights our reliance on visual abstractions perfectly. What's fascinating here is how we just trust the psychological comfort of the interface, right?
Right, the green
Yeah,
light.
the green light, the padlock icon, with ever verifying the actual underlying mechanics. When the interface lies to us, our entire threat model just collapses because we've outsourced our vigilance to a piece of plastic.
And that collapse, that exact collapse of the threat model, is really the current pulling today's sources together for you. We've got a stack of stories from the Tech and AI Daily Digest for April 10th,
That's
2026.
a heavy stack today.
It is. And our mission today is to cut through all that noise and find those vital aha moments just for you. The overarching theme tying this deep dive together is trust, vulnerability, and transparency.
Yeah, we're really looking at the cracks in our technological foundations right now.
And how the tech world is desperately trying to patch them up. Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with that fake security panel on the wall, which in this case happens to be Mako.
Yeah, the erosion of trust in Mako's sandboxing. It's a perfect example of that interface decoupling from reality. The sources point out that the privacy and security pane, where you toggle permissions for the mic or the
You
camera,
monthly click every day, yeah.
exactly. It doesn't accurately reflect what applications are actually doing at the system level. You might see a toggle flipped off for a specific app, but that app is still it's still reading your directories.
I look at that and I just wonder, like, is this technical debt or is Apple deliberately obscuring the complexity just to maintain the illusion of this pristine walled garden?
That's the big question.
Right, because if I toggle a switch off and the OS just ignores it, what is actually breaking down under the hood? Like, why is the UI lying to me?
Well, it comes down to the architecture of macOS's transparency, consent, and control framework.
Not the TCC, right.
Right, the TCC. That database is supposed to be the ultimate source of truth for user permissions. But, I mean, modern operating systems are just incredibly complex now.
Yeah, there's so much going on in the background.
Exactly. You have background daemons, legacy kernel extensions, XPC services, which those handle inter-process communication. So an app might not have direct permission to read your files, but it might call a background service that does have that permission.
Oh, I see. So the UI is only showing you the front door.
Precisely. While the app is quietly using, like a dumb waiter in the back to move your data around, the synchronization between that visual wrapper and the underlying POCX layer has just entirely fractured.
That makes the concept of sandboxing feel less like a secure container and more like, I don't know, a polite suggestion.
A very polite, very ignorable suggestion.
And if we can't trust the operating system's native tools that Apple gives us, it makes the next story in our stack even more alarming.
The CPUID hijack.
Yes, because it's one thing when the OS is confusing, but it's another when the foundational tools we download to actively diagnose our systems turn into weapons. So the CPUID website was hijacked.
Right. And CPUID, they're the developers behind CPUZ and HW Monitor. If you build PCs or if you overclock or run diagnostics, I mean, these tools are practically mandatory.
Everyone uses them.
Yeah. So the hijack of their primary distribution server to serve Trojanized, malware-infected installers, that is a catastrophic breach of trust.
I want to look at the psychology of this attack vector for a second, because attackers aren't just, picking random software to infect.
No, it's very targeted.
When you download a hardware monitor, you are in a troubleshooting mindset. You're actively trying to fix something, which means the moment Windows asks if you want to run this program as an administrator, you're going to click yes without a second thought.
You've hit on the exact mechanism that makes this so incredibly dangerous. Hardware monitoring tools, they require ring zero access.
And Ring Zero is the deepest level, right?
The deepest, the most privileged level of the operating system kernel.
Cool.
It's totally necessary to pull thermal sensors and voltage regulators directly from the motherboard.
Wow.
So by compromising CPU-Z, the attackers aren't just sneaking onto your machine. The user is willingly handing them kernel-level execution rights.
They just bypass everything.
Yeah, they bypass standard antivirus heuristics completely because the user explicitly authorized the elevation.
So the call is literally coming from inside the house, and we just handed the intruder the master keys.
Basically, yes.
But let's take that a step further into the browser space. Because the sources detail the situation with the JSON formatter Chrome extension.
Oh, this one is rough.
It's a massive tool for developers, and it recently changed hands. The original developer sold it. And the new owner immediately started injecting adware directly into the browser. There was no hack here, right?
No hack at all. No hijacked server.
Nothing like that.
This is the quietest and arguably most insidious form of a supply chain attack.
Mm.
The vulnerability isn't in the code. The vulnerability is in the Chrome Web Store's update mechanism, and honestly, the human element of ownership.
Because once that developer transfers the ownership ID to a new Google account, the Web Store's automated pipeline just blindly pushes the new owner's payload to hundreds of thousands of browsers.
Exactly. The users never even see an install prompt.
It just updates quietly in the background.
Right. It operates on pure economics.
Mm-hmm.
Malicious actors have realized that trying to find a zero-day exploit in a modern browser is incredibly expensive and difficult.
Yeah, the bounties on those are huge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it is far cheaper to find an exhausted open source developer maintaining a popular extension for free, offer them five figures for the rights, and then just weaponize the established user base.
Wow. So the trust chain is bought, not broken.
Perfectly said. Bought. Not broken.
So we are seeing trust evaporate at the OS level, the application level, and the browser level. It creates this really claustrophobic digital anxiety.
It really does.
But the digest shows what happens when that anxiety, that friction from this rapid, opaque technological shift spills over the digital borders and enters physical reality.
Yeah, this is where things get very serious.
According to the New York Times reporting in our stack today, a Molotov cocktail was thrown at the residence of OpenAI CEO Sam Altman in San Francisco.
Yeah, this represents a severe, factual, physical manifestation of societal tension.
Mm-hmm.
Moving from online hostility to incendiary devices at a private residence, that is an escalation that changes the entire risk landscape for the tech sector.
And we should be very clear for you listening, we're strictly reporting the facts of this escalation. We're not taking sides on AI politics or anti-AI sentiment. We're just noting that this is a factual escalation of hostility without endorsing either side's underlying viewpoint.
Exactly. The incident itself is what matters for the landscape.
Right. And looking at the trajectory of this, I have to question the standard narrative that tech leaders will simply retreat into heavily guarded compounds. Doesn't escalation like this actually force these companies into hiding? Or does it permanently change how they interact with the public?
That is a great question.
Because the mythology of Silicon Valley has always been, you know, the accessible founder in the local coffee shop. If that becomes too dangerous, do we see a shift away from concentrated tech hubs entirely, moving toward anonymous distributed leadership teams?
I think a decentralized physical footprint is a highly plausible outcome here. Historically, the geographic concentration in San Francisco, it facilitated a very specific type of pseudo-public corporate culture.
Right, everyone bumping into each other.
Yeah. But rapid technological advancements, particularly those involving artificial intelligence, they generate massive macroeconomic and societal friction.
Yeah, people are scared for their jobs.
Exactly. When models are opaque and the public feels entirely left out of the decision-making process regarding tools that could automate their livelihoods, that perceived lack of agency breeds hostility.
So the leaders become physically distant exactly when the technology they are building is becoming more intimately woven into our daily lives.
Which creates a really dangerous feedback loop. Think about it. The public feels the tech is unaccountable. The leaders experience physical threats, so they expand executive protection and retreat behind these sanitized corporate barriers.
And that retreat makes the technology feel even more opaque and untouchable.
Exactly. Which in turn fuels more public anxiety. It's a sociological pressure cooker.
So how do you decompress that? If digital systems are compromised by supply chain economics and the physical world is escalating into violence, how does the engineering community actually rebuild trust?
It's not easy.
According to the second half of our sources, it seems the survival tactic is radical transparency. And here's where it gets really interesting. Let's talk about the Linux kernel.
Oh, this is a watershed moment for open source governance. The Linux community recently merged official documentation outlining exactly how contributors can and cannot use AI coding assistance.
And the Linux kernel maintainers are notoriously strict, right? Unforgiving, even.
Extremely strict, yeah.
To me, this feels like the strictest English teacher in school suddenly handing out calculators in an essay writing class, or like a master carpenter suddenly allowing automated power tools in an artisanal workshop. You can use the nail gun, but you're still personally responsible for ensuring the joints don't collapse.
That is a very accurate framing, because the Linux kernel isn't standard application software. It manages the hardware-software interface for the majority of the world's servers and devices.
It's the foundation.
Right. And the programming language used, C, requires manual memory management. If a developer uses a large language model to write a patch, the AI might output code that is syntactically flawless.
It looks perfect on the surface.
Right, but it might introduce a really subtle pointer arithmetic error or erase condition.
And because the code looks clean at first glance, human reviewers might experience fatigue and just, wave it through.
That is the exact mechanism of failure they are trying to prevent. By merging official documentation on AI usage, Linus Torvalds' team is forcing developers to take explicit, documented human responsibility for the logic.
So they are establishing a transparent chain of accountability.
Yes, it acknowledges that AI tools are ubiquitous now, but it demands that the human submitting the code understands the underlying mechanics well enough to defend it line by line.
Transparency is a structural requirement. I like that. We see another angle of this with Bluesky. They just published a highly detailed postmortem of their April 2026 outage.
I read that. It was very thorough.
Yeah, they literally laid out the machinery on the table and pointed to the exact gear that snapped. I contrast this with something like, say, AWS, where a major region goes offline and the status page just says degraded performance for 6 hours.
Yeah, that opacity doesn't work for Bluesky. They operate on the AT protocol, which is a federated distributed system. And in a distributed system, transparency isn't just good PR. It is an operational necessity.
How so?
Well, when a centralized service fails, the provider holds all the diagnostic data. But when a federated network desynchronizes, independent node operators need to know exactly why the state machine failed.
Because if they don't explain the failure at a deep technical level, those independent operators lose faith in the protocol itself and migrate away.
Exactly. The postmortem educates the community. It invites peer review of the failure. By explaining the exact database query or load balancer misconfiguration that triggered the cascade, they're telling their users and developers that they respect their technical literacy.
Great. Which builds a far more resilient ecosystem than just offering vague apologies.
Way more resilient, yes.
No, sometimes enforcing that transparent security involves battling through what looks like bureaucratic red tape. The sources note that WireGuard finally pushed a new Windows release. Yeah, but this only happened after a massive delay caused by a code signing dispute with Microsoft. I look at that, and part of me thinks, is Microsoft just leveraging its OS monopoly to gatekeep a superior open-source VPN protocol?
It's really easy to view it through a monopolistic lens, I admit. But the technical reality of kernel mode code signing in Windows tells a very different story.
Oh, really?
Yeah, WireGuard isn't a standard user space application. It needs deep hooks into the Windows network stack to handle packet routing efficiently. To operate at that level, Microsoft requires an extended validation or EV certificate.
Which basically guarantees cryptographic proof of the developer's identity, right?
Yes, exactly. The Windows kernel checks that cryptographic signature before it allows the driver to load. If Microsoft relaxes those code signing strictures, they open the door for the exact type of ring zero rootkits we just discussed with the CPU-Z hijack.
Oh, okay, that makes total sense.
Right. So the dispute with WireGuard, while frustrating for users waiting for an update, is actually the security architecture functioning properly.
Yeah.
It's applying necessary friction to ensure that highly privileged network drivers haven't been tampered with in transit.
So we've navigated the complexities of software trust from the intricacies of Linux memory management to federated network state machines and Windows kernel cryptography. But the spirit of openness we're seeing is now bleeding into the physical world.
Yeah, the hardware layer.
Right. And this is where the realities of infinite digital bits clash violently with the hard limits of physical atoms. Keychron, the mechanical keyboard company, just dropped full CAD and hardware design files on GitHub.
Open sourcing the industrial design.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. It allows the right to repair community to modify, iterate, or even 3D print custom replacement parts directly from the manufacturer's blueprints.
So what does this all mean when we zoom out? Because I see a glaring, almost tragic contradiction in today's stack. We live in an era where Keychron gives us the files to 3D print a keyboard chassis in our living rooms, but the actual silicon chips inside that keyboard might stall on the production line because we are running out of helium, a gas that most of the public associates with party balloons is suddenly a critical choke point for global computing. How did we get here? Break down the actual manufacturing bottleneck for me.
This raises an important question, doesn't it? The bottleneck lies in extreme ultraviolet lithography, or EUV.
EUV, okay.
Yeah, this is the cutting-edge process used to etch microscopic transistor patterns onto silicon wafers. EUV lithography occurs in a vacuum, and it generates massive amounts of thermal energy. You're essentially harnessing plasma.
Oh, wow.
So you have to pull that intense heat away from the silicon wafer incredibly fast, or the wafer is just destroyed.
And I'm assuming you can't just blow air on it or use water cooling, given the chemical volatility of that environment.
Exactly. You need a backside cooling gas that is completely inert, meaning it won't react with the exotic chemicals in the chamber, and it must have exceptionally high thermal conductivity.
And that's helium.
Helium is literally the only element on the periodic table that fits those requirements and doesn't liquefy at the extreme temperatures required, especially when they're also using it to cool superconducting magnets in adjacent tech sectors, like MRI machines.
But wait, we can't just synthesize it.
No. Helium is a non-renewable resource. It's typically extracted as a byproduct of natural gas mining. And the kicker is, once it escapes into the atmosphere, it is light enough to break Earth's gravitational pull and just bleed off into space.
So it's quite literally vanishing.
Forever, yes.
I compare that elemental reality to the brief mention in today's sources about the Eve OpenClaw launch on Hacker News.
Oh, right, the managed hosting layer.
Yeah, a team spins up a managed OpenClaw hosting layer, they deploy it via containers, and it scales globally in minutes. Software scalability feels like magic, but the physical servers executing that magic are hitting an unyielding wall of atmospheric physics.
That's the tension. You can infinitely replicate the software architecture, but you cannot copy and paste an atomic element. The most beautifully transparent, perfectly code-signed operating system is completely useless without the physical silicon to process its instructions.
So, looking at the journey we've taken today, we started by unmasking the illusions of digital safety. We had Mako databases out of sync with their UI and trusted diagnostic tools weaponized through supply chain economics.
Right.
Then we examined the severe sociological friction of AI spilling into physical violence. And finally, we explored how the community is fighting back with radical transparency and open source software, only to hit the uncompromising wall of physical resource scarcity.
Let's follow that thread of physical scarcity to its logical, perhaps inevitable conclusion.
Okay, where does it lead?
Currently, the tech industry treats software as somewhat disposable. We tolerate adware, we accept bloated applications, and we endure poorly optimized code because computing power has historically been cheap, abundant, and constantly following Moore's law.
Yeah, we just throw more RAM at the problem.
Exactly. But if we are facing unyielding physical limits, like helium shortages, fundamentally capping semiconductor manufacturing, what happens when computing power simply becomes too expensive to waste?
Wow, that is a massive paradigm shift. If the hardware gets incredibly precious, the software has to get perfect.
Exactly. Will the harsh reality of hardware scarcity eventually force a cultural reset in computer science? Could the lack of physical resources be the catalyst that forces developers to write highly optimized, hyper-efficient, and inherently secure code, effectively ending the era of cheap, disposable, and vulnerable bloatware?
When the physical limits of the planet force the digital world to finally clean up its act, that is an incredible thought to chew on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the sources today. We covered a lot of complex ground, and hopefully we extracted some real aha moments for you to carry with you.
Yeah, it's a lot to think about.
Remember to always keep questioning what you read, look for the hidden mechanisms driving the headlines, and most importantly, double check that the security panel by your front door isn't just a drawing. We'll catch you next time.